Welcome to Pencils Down, a Finalis podcast. This is a show for listeners wanting to learn more about the ins and outs of the private securities brokerage landscape. Each episode will feature insightful conversations with the world's leading investment bankers, placement agents, capital providers, startup CEOs, and more. And with that, let's get into the show. Shubham Goel, thanks so much for joining us here on Pencils Down.
Thank you. Thank you, Fed, for having me. This is exciting.
It's so great to have you here. So I usually like to start by asking our guests to share a little bit about their backgrounds and the various paths that they took to get them to where they are today. In your case, obviously, that of being a startup co-founder together with Reizu. Can you share a little bit with our audience about yourself and how you and Ray found yourself to Affinity?
Totally. Happy to tell you a little bit about our story. So, you know, we started a company called Affinity. You know, we are building the relationship intelligence platform for deal makers in relationship-driven industries to help them, you know, manage, find and close their best deals. We have about, 2,500 customers today in about 80 countries all over the world. So the way Affinity got started, I started the company with Ray. We were actually students at Stanford back in the day, 7 years ago, and we started the business. And really, Affinity was started through, I would say, a combination of, some intent, but a lot of serendipity. We were a part of this incubator program over one of the summers when we were in college. During the summer, we had a chance to meet some amazing people across a whole myriad of industries in finance and in philanthropy and real estate. And it is actually through meeting all these people that we discovered, that folks across very different, walks of life were kind of doing the same thing. They were managing relationships for a living. When we sort of started digging in a little bit into how they were doing that and what processes they were using to do that, we got one of two responses. Either people were really, really excited to talk about it because they thought we could solve their problems, or they really didn't want to talk about it and they kind of were like, ran away from the topic. So either way, we knew there was a lot of pain there. And that's where we sort of, we were engineers by training. And so we looked at the problem slightly differently, and we said, maybe there's a way we can solve this through the advent of data, which was, happening in a big way at the time. And so the combination of us looking and discovering this problem and, the tools that help you organize data just becoming possible around sort of 2014, 2015, sort of we put the two things together alongside Joe Lonsdale, who was also the co-founder of Palantir. He was involved with the business from the very early days. We put the business together and, haven't looked back since. So that's how things came together. Ray and I took a leave from Stanford to build this company.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think I was just on your LinkedIn profile a little earlier. And, I graduated from college in 2005. And in 2005, it was a relatively rare occurrence of hearing about, somebody dropping out to start a new company. And in literally 5 years, I feel like that very much shifted. And obviously, you were at Stanford, and I think you had, some folks come before you, quite notable folks, dropouts that were able to build large technology companies. Tell me a little bit about how that ecosystem informed the decision to leave Stanford and ultimately start your own tech company.
It really kind of, boiled down to, I think, a place like Stanford, what it does is, it's filled with a lot of enthusiasm and excitement. And I think it's true for any ecosystem, but I think, when you look at sort of the people that you idolize in the ecosystem, you bias your future towards the opinions and intentions of what folks share in that ecosystem. And I think a lot of what we heard was, now's the best time. You've clearly identified some problems and pain points that seem to have a really, really big market opportunity. So why don't you take a crack at it? And what's the worst thing that can happen? You know, you might fail. Well, in that case, you're very capable engineers, and I'm sure, you know, you could go find some great jobs. So I think, you know, that sort of thought process made a lot of sense to us. The downside was fairly low, and you know, the opportunity cost was high. So we said, okay, well, let's take a stab at this and see where it goes. And I think that's how we thought about it. I don't think, you know, when you're that young, I actually don't think most people understand how long it takes to build an enduring company. We certainly didn't. So, you know, we took the approach of let's try it, see what happens and go from there. And then, you know, now it's year seven.
Yeah, I think of it as almost strategic naivete, because the naivete works to your advantage early on when you're taking the plunge, because you don't really fully understand the extent of what you're getting yourself into. Ultimately, you know, the success of any enterprise is a function of a lot of grit and grind. You know, Affinity is no exception to that. I do note, though, that, you know, along the way, you and Ray have been able to distinguish yourselves with respect to the way that you've gone about building and scaling the business. I know that in 2019, the both of you were recognized with the Forbes 30 Under 30 recognition. Tell me a little bit about how that recognition changed the trajectory of your respective careers, or maybe to put it a little differently, you know, what did it validate about the success that the both of you were already experiencing with Affinity and taking it to that point?
Yeah, I remember actually vividly the day, you know, the Forbes article came out with sort of our name in it. You know, I think of these things, company building especially, you know, is really a marathon, right? And I'm sure that analogy has been overused in startup folklore. But I think, you know, when you think about it like a marathon, you know, you're experiencing a lot of pain while you're going through it. So honestly, moments like that are very validating for the team. But personally, yourself, you know, it's not like you feel that different. You know, you're on to the next challenge. You know, you're on to the next mile, right, that you're trying to run. So I think it was a really, really big moment for the team, because, you know, it made things like recruiting easier. You know, folks on the team could tell their friends about it. You know, it gave them, you know, gave the company more legitimacy, right? And all of those things help with customers, they help with future recruiting, it helps with fundraising to some extent. But I think on a personal level, you know, it didn't really change anything too much, because again, you're on this marathon and you're on to the next mile. You're thinking about the next mile already by the time things like this happen. So that's sort of how I would describe the feeling, you know, when it came out. People were very excited. We were certainly excited as well, but and not to downplay the achievement, but you know, I think it was much more applicable and made the team really happy.
So in the interview that you gave to the Forbes Enterprise Technology blog in connection with being named to the 30 Under 30, you mentioned something that really stood out to me, which is that, you know, what was driving you to build new technologies at Affinity was the opportunity to democratize that technology, that new generation of relationship management tools and vision. And what struck a chord in me is that that's pretty much what we're trying to accomplish at Finalis. We're really looking to democratize access to the middle markets and the private capital markets for investment bankers and other boutiques. And, you know, it seems to me that, you know, while Finalis is still very much at the beginning of its own narrative, you and the team at Affinity already have gone quite a far way in terms of trying to realize that objective, at least with respect to relationship management tools. And so I really have a two-part question here. The first is, you know, how has that democratizing vision been manifested or made real for Affinity? In other words, how far along do you think you've made inroads into creating a new business relationship management paradigm for everyone from individual consumers to enterprises? And here I'll, of course, include your investment banking customers. And then secondly, what advice or insights can you give to those of us who are holding similar democratizing values, who are just at the start of our own journeys as startups?
Both great questions, Fred. So let me start with the first one, which is, you know, how do we think about our own progress? You know, it's funny, we when we were in year one or year two, we sort of created this, you know, three-phase strategy as a company in you know, what will help us accomplish our long-term vision. And, you know, our long-term vision is to help every single professional, whether it be, doesn't matter if it's a student graduating from college or a Fortune 500 CEO, to better leverage and harness their network to succeed, right? So it's a very ambitious vision that we want to drive the company towards. And so we created this three-phase strategy, you know, in year one or year two. And the funny thing is, after, you know, 5 years of execution, you know, after going from having zero to now almost 2,500 customers in pretty much, you know, almost all Western countries of the world, you know, we still look at that strategy and we are like, you know, like we're in the same place that we were 7 years ago. And you know, I think this sort of word of, you know, it's day one, we're just getting started. You know, they're overused phrases in the start, again, startup folklore. But I do think that when you have a big vision and a very ambitious vision that you're driving towards, they are true for a very long time, you know. I mean, literally, like, you know, we want to create products that go across markets, that, you know, power the entire relationship-driven economy, all relationship-driven industries. And so far, you know, we have made some great headway. But, you know, when you look at the overall opportunity, we're not even 1% there. So I think, you know, it's humbling to look at that strategy and look at sort of how far we have come every day, which is not even 1% there. So I think that's how we think about our progress. I mean, not to downplay again the customers that we serve today. It's awesome to see the customer base we have had and the love that we receive from our customers. But, you know, on the path to actually democratizing the ability for people to manage relationships, you know, we're a long way. We're long, long way off. You know, it's going to be a very interesting 5 to 10 year journey from here. And I'm pretty sure, you know, in 10 years we'll say the same thing, which is, hey, we're one, you know, maybe 1%, maybe 1.5% there. So I think that's the power of ambitious visions. I actually think it's really good it is this way, because it always keeps the team, you know, and the grandeur of what you want to do in the world front and center with the team. It's always an ambitious, asymptotic sort of thing that you're trying to drive towards. So that's my first answer. The second question that you asked, which is sort of advice on, you know, insights on other folks who are thinking about this. I think, you know, sort of maybe building on what I just said, I think one is having a very clear long-term vision, which is very inspiring and can sort of motivate not just yourself, but you know, everybody around you, every employee, every customer, every investor. Something that, you know, if you were able to do that, you would literally change the world. You know, I think that's really, really important. So I think setting a really grand vision is important, and a strategy that, you know, makes it possible as well. Apart from that, I think, look, like, you know, I think of these, phases or the strategy as, you know, sort of acts in a play, right? Like, you need to complete the first act to unlock the next one. So I think while the long-term stuff is really important, you have to always obsess over your customers and keep them front and center of everything that you do in your business. I mean, you know, we have tried to do this at Affinity, where, you know, we track, you know, customer love is one of our top order metrics. You know, we talk about NPS, we talk about, you know, how do we best serve our customers in the spaces that we are in today. So I think it's really, really important to sort of tie the two together, which is your long-term vision shouldn't be so disconnected from what you're doing today. And again, the customers you have today are going to unlock the next act of your growth. So those are the two things I'd probably mention. You know, one is the grand, you know, sort of setting a clear long-term vision, and then two, being obsessed with the current act that you're in and not losing sight and focus.
I chuckle because I often use the metaphor of multiple acts to the finalist play in the context of internally articulating our own vision for how we're going to be expanding market opportunities within the context of the capital markets here. So I guess I wasn't that creative. I must have, you know, previously read an interview that you gave where it was already being used. But I did want to double click a little bit on what you were mentioning on customer love, because that is an area where, you know, I feel like oftentimes, you know, we read all of these articles or hear all of these interviews One of the interviews that I heard recently, and I reheard recently, was one given by Jeff Bezos in the late 90s, in the early days of Amazon. And there was something about the way that he articulated his the Amazon's obsessive focus on the customer that really landed with me. And, you know, I think that, you know, that was one of the things that I picked up early on in the context of building and scaling Finalis, that ultimately our success was going to be a direct function of our ability to deliver and sustain real cost customer value. But one of the areas that I have found to be somewhat challenging at times has been how to galvanize that idea or that notion across the entire business when, by its very nature, there will be people that are customer facing and there will be quite a large number of people that are not customer facing. And how do you galvanize this notion of empathy with the customer among a whole subsegment of an employee base that doesn't necessarily have those direct customer touch points? Would be curious to hear you riff a little bit about, you know, kind of where the strategies that perhaps have been employed at Affinity to try and bridge this.
Yeah, totally. It's a great question. And it's, you know, I think it's one of those things, again, that, you know, almost every company, I think, struggles with to some degree, you know, and we're all trying to find our way towards it. And I think Amazon's actually probably one of the extreme, like, best examples where, you know, the sort of very popular story of having a you know, when we were all back in the office, having a chair, you know, with a you know, sort of virtual customer. You know, customers always in the room in every meeting kind of situation. But, you know, I think, look, there's some ways we have approached this at Affinity, which have made a big impact. One is, I think you have to find a way to share effectively stories of what's happening with customers, what's happening with prospects back into the whole company. You know, whether it be in all hands meetings, whether it be, you know, another forum created just for this, I think it's really, really important for everybody to hear what the client-facing, customer-facing folks are hearing from the customer. And I think this evolves over time, right? Like in the very, very early days, we didn't really have a notion of a customer success. And, you know, everybody, product, engineering, regardless of function, you know, had to do customer support. You know, everybody got the support at affinity.co email. So if a customer wrote in, they would experience the pain themselves and see it, right? And two, you know, we had our product engineering folks literally go to the customer alongside whoever was helping, you know, sell the product to the customer and see, you know, and literally see it in action as to what's happening, what are they doing, what are they liking about it, what are they not liking about it. That doesn't scale, you know, it was really good in the early days, but what it does do is, you know, it creates an initial sense of empathy within your product and engineering team, so that when the sixth or seventh or eighth person joins your company on the engineering side, you know, the first five folks have a really good understanding of what customers like, what are they not like, how are they going to react to different situations, so that empathy starts getting distributed across the team and everybody starts thinking like a customer as opposed to not having any contact with them, right? So I think that's one thing that you can do in the early days to make sure that, you know, the foundation is more customer obsessed than anything else. As you scale, I think there's a few things we have found effective. One is, you know, sharing stories of what's happening with customers, whether a customer truly loves us or, you know, they don't find as much value and it was a learning experience for us. We share both kinds of stories in our all hands meetings, you know, in our go-to-market meetings, go-to-market kickoffs, you know, and really bring these stories together to educate the whole company around what's happening, how are folks doing, you know, what are we hearing, cohorts, testimonials, things like that. And I think that, you know, helps really, again, continue to educate the whole company around it. We also get our product managers really deeply embedded with customers when they're designing features and things like that, so that they're not designing in isolation and they're designing with the customer. And what happens is, again, due to that glue, they'll pull some engineering folks into those discussions, into prototyping and things like that. So you know, the product engineering build departments get to see how customers are doing and what they're facing in action as well. So those are, again, some ways that we have tried to do this. You know, the last thing I'll say on this is, you know, making some metric around customer love, customer obsession be a top order metric in the company so that people are forced to think about it and have to do something about it. Whether it be NPS, you know, or weekly actives or DAO MAU or something that sort of goes to show that, you know, we care about this. I think that's another interesting approach you could take. So anyway, just some ideas. I think we're still discovering our own, you know, best answer to this question. These are some things that we have tried to do and implement at different points of time.
No, and some of them are very rich ideas that I'm already thinking about, you know, us starting to implement in our own context. So thank you for sharing those. Just to shift gears a little bit, you know, as this has been obviously the last couple of years have been a really interesting time to engage in technology company building and scaling, obviously with the COVID-19 pandemic being that prototypical black swan event that we've all been experiencing and navigating our way through. Obviously, there's unforeseen consequences that are still playing out in real time, not just in business, but in work-life practices of individuals, firms, how we live, how we work, and so on. Tell me a little bit about how this exogenous shock of COVID has made a difference, if at all, in the way that you're strategizing about Affinity's business model, or even the way in which Affinity works moving forward.
It's a really good question. So I think there's a couple of components of this. One is it all starts again with the customer, right? So you have to, you know, when COVID hit, we really sort of thought about, okay, well, you know, what happens to our customers and what happens to the impact our technology has on our customers? And I think we sort of, after having 3 to 6 months of data on that, you know, we developed a thesis on what was happening. You know, I think fortunately for us, you know, two things happened. One, you know, even small teams were now distributed. So suddenly the context on any relationship, any deal, you know, you couldn't just turn to the other person and say, hey, what's going on with that deal or what's going on with that relationship? If you were in the same office, folks had to find other ways to get that answer. And so we actually saw usage on our core product go through the roof. You know, folks started using Affinity more than they had ever used in the you know, pre-COVID. So I think that was really interesting, as it kind of validated that, you know, that Affinity was a really important tool, especially through this time for our customers. And then the second thing was, you know, we are selling into, you know, primarily financial services industries and a lot of private capital industries where, you know, the customers' revenues are not necessarily tied to the markets. You know, a lot of our customers sort of operate on a management fee structure. You know, they raise a fund and they sort of pay for Affinity through their management fees. And I think between both of those things, we realized that, you know, we were going to be very resilient as a business, you know, going through COVID and into the new world. So I think from a business standpoint, we've actually invested a lot more into the company over the last, you know, year and a half. I mean, literally our business has, I think, gone from, you know, we were 100 folks a year and a half ago. Now we're almost 250 people in the company, going to about 300 soon. So the business has really, really grown. And I think that investment, again, came because of the thesis that customers needed our product more than ever, they were using it more than ever, and the industry was not slowing down. So that's sort of the first piece. The second piece on you know, you mentioned the impact has gone beyond just work. And I totally agree, right? Like, I mean, you know, I think I was one of those people who never thought that you know, anyone could work remotely, and now here we are, right? Totally different world. And I think we have embraced that world, you know, coming out of the pandemic. So, you know, our company is now almost fully remote. We're sort of in a hybrid model, but, you know, most employees, almost 90% of our employees work remotely today. And so we have embraced that. We have given our employees lots of flexibility in working wherever they feel comfortable. We still have, you know, sort of different collaboration spaces throughout wherever we have employees, but most of our employees are working from home. And I think that's the future, is what you'll see is, you know, folks prefer to be working from home, especially in tech. But what we are seeing is that, you know, nothing can replace in-person interaction and collaboration and you know, just sort of hanging out and bonding with your team. So I think the structure has to be something where, you know, the company is flexible enough where, you know, on a quarterly basis or some kind of cadence, the teams get together, meet, you know, do some team bonding, do some strategic planning, and then sort of go off and continue working remotely. So I think there's a balance there, but, you know, the primary mode is certainly going to be more remote for us in the future.
Yeah, I think for us, as a very young startup, that was, we literally launched our core product in the second month of COVID. The remote context, to a certain extent, it helped the business because it democratized access to talent in a really interesting way, because we were now no longer limited by talent that we might be able to source here in the San Francisco Bay Area, which, as you know, is the most competitive talent market, at least in the technology industry in the United States, but that we could kind of be open to recruiting talent from across the country and even overseas. And that has been, I think, for us, a net benefit out of this, is the freedom to recruit and retain talent in a remote context. But I completely agree with you that this context does create a new set of challenges that perhaps didn't exist before. Specifically for us, I think it's around this notion of collaboration across functional areas oftentimes becomes an issue, because folks are quite literally siloed within their own Slack channels sometimes, and they're not necessarily identifying or exercising opportunities to reach across into other functional areas where perhaps similar questions have already been asked and answered. And that does create some thrash when some of those issues come to a head. So it's definitely, for us as well, very much a living experiment as we continue to find the right modality to bring people together. Because I do agree with you that experience is very invaluable. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about Affinity as it relates to this vertical that Finalis spends a lot of time in, which is the investment banking vertical. Share a little bit about kind of the birth of that, you know, industry focus area for Affinity and what has driven that. And also, you know, where are the opportunities that you see as you continue to grow in the number of investment banking customers that you have on the Affinity platform?
For sure, yeah, Fed. So, you know, I think investment banking is one of our, you know, big focus areas, has been for the last year, and it's going to continue to be for the coming years. And, you know, the opportunity really grew very organically for us. You know, we started selling into the private capital markets, and you know, we ended up noticing that, you know, investors were telling their friends about the product and how it was saving them so much time and helping them focus on what they do best, which is build relationships. And a lot of those friends, you know, turned out to be bankers. And so, you know, we started getting all this sort of organic demand onto the product from folks in the banking world. And before we knew it, you know, we had a really sort of foundational corpus of customers already in the vertical. And when we looked at how they were using the product, how they were benefiting from the product, it was very, very similar in a lot of ways to the markets where we started. So we said, hey, why don't we do more here? You know, why don't we go really sort of make many more customers here successful in both, you know, helping find the right opportunities and sort of, you know, cutting out the inefficiency in getting the right introductions to potential buyers or sellers, as well as managing deals through the funnel and through the process, really making sure that things are as automated as possible. And so that's kind of what we do for customers today, you know, and we've had the fortune of hearing very exciting things about what our product is doing for customers in the space. And so we couldn't be more excited about it and continue to double down on it.
Well, we obviously share your excitement. Part of the reason why we were so excited to partner with Affinity and to engage in a webinar that we did together, and now to dive into this podcast, because we do see that, you know, similar to Affinity, we see a tremendous opportunity in digitally transforming the stack that investment bankers are experiencing, which really has been relatively untouched by technology over the last number of decades. I was taking a look recently at your recent benchmark report, and after seeing seven new banks enter the top 20 by deal count, it certainly looks like smaller firms are starting to compete more effectively. You know, what do you think is potentially driving this change?
Yeah, I mean, Fed, I think in the past, you know, we've had, you know, the bulge bracket banks have had a huge advantage, right, due to their size as well as deep connections with buyers and sellers. And I think what we are seeing now is that, you know, boutiques and mid-market banks are able to really punch above their weight class. I think there's a number of factors here, obviously. You know, one would be specialization, for example. So, you know, investing in and really building out specialized practices. And of course, you know, betting on the right hot sectors, especially tech, you know, that's really paid off big time for a lot of the biggest names on that list. But a very important lever that I think we shouldn't discount, and I think you're just getting to this, is technology, right? I mean, all of these new banks that are entering the top 10 for the first time are very likely taking advantage of technology that make their processes more efficient and helps them better leverage their relationships and the advantages that they already have, right? I think that's key to winning in a competitive landscape. I mean, just volume is not enough, right? It's about the quality, specifically quality connections. So that's kind of my viewpoint on it.
Yeah, no, super interesting. And then just a follow-up to that, you know, what methods do you think are proven to leverage technology to help or enable banks to deliver better results in your experience?
Totally. I think maybe I can speak for Affinity here a little bit and sort of, you know, how we have seen folks use the Affinity platform to really improve their process. I think there's two things that we have seen you know, investment banks do. One is, you know, by analyzing the entire bank's network with relationship intelligence, we're able to provide customers with the best path to uncovering the right introduction, right, to the right prospective client or a potential buyer. And so banks are now suddenly able to identify the right warm introduction much more quickly to get to the right buyer or the right seller. And I mean, you know, there's a statistic we talk about a lot, which is, you know, firms that sort of average over 175 warm introductions per month actually saw their, you know, see their mandates close 21% faster. So, you know, ultimately it's a people and relationship business, right? And so I think that's one component where we have seen technology really improve the process. Another place where we have seen it really improve the process is around data automation, right? I mean, you know, I would say if you stack rank all the highest ROI generating activities, you know, a bank could be working on, you know, I think you'll quickly realize that all of the highest ROI things in the ways you can maximize your time, you know, is about building more relationships, right? I mean, probably something like over 95% of what bankers spend their time on today and should be spending their time on today is that. And that's how you maximize your ROI of your time, is being in meetings, building relationships, talking to potential buyers or sellers. And there's already sort of way too much to do and not enough time to do this. And at the bottom of this list is entering data into a CRM by hand, right? So if you can cut away that process, you know, take away data entry out of the picture, that not only helps these banks spend more time with building relationships, but also helps helps the collaboration piece on any particular deal that's ongoing to move it much faster. So those are the two things that we have seen, you know, technology really enable banks to do. But I'm sure with what Finalis is doing and, you know, what other folks are doing in this space, you know, there's just, if you're not using technology as a bank today, you know, you're falling behind. You know, that's sort of what we are hearing from our customers as well.
And finally, Shubham, in closing, you know, what can investment banks start to expect to see in the Affinity product in the months and years to come? You know, share a little bit or provide a bit of a preview with respect to the types of features and functionalities that investment banks can come to expect out of Affinity.
100%, Fed. So a couple of things. I think one is, look, we are really about automating our data entry, right? That's one of our core value propositions. And so we're going to continue to do more there. You know, you can expect to see more data partners, more data integrations. So folks don't have to go to many different platforms to understand, you know, the 360 degree view of, you know, who's the right seller, who's the right buyer, what are we doing with them? You know, who do we go after? We're trying to bring answers to as many questions as possible of those kinds in one platform, in a seamless way, where data entry, again, is just out of the picture, right? So I think folks can expect to see us do more there. I think another thing that we are sort of thinking about is taking all of this data automation and the relationship intelligence and putting it where folks are working, right? So, you know, today folks leverage the Affinity platform, they leverage it as a part of, you know, going to the Affinity website and running their workflow. But a lot of our customers spend a ton of time in Outlook, or they'll spend a ton of time on LinkedIn and all these other tools. And so we're trying to build actually a whole slew of extensions that take the power of Affinity and actually put it where you are in your workflow. So you can expect, you know, bankers can expect to see more things like an Outlook integration, a better Outlook integration, you know, integrating with things like LinkedIn over time. So those are other areas, you know, on our roadmap. And then the last thing I'll mention is just ease of use. You know, we are just want to be the easiest thing ever that a banker has to use, and, you know, don't have to spend brain cycles trying to learn a new tool. So we want to feel like it's home, and that's the third area that we're working on and focusing on.
Well, that's an incredibly exciting pipeline of new features and functionalities that investment banks can come to expect in the days to come. And on that positive note, Shubham, thank you so much for joining us here on the Pencils Down podcast. Thanks so much to you and to the broader Affinity team for welcoming us as a partner as we continue to explore ways together to digitally transform the investment banking space. Very much looking forward to deepening that partnership in the days to come. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Fed. It's amazing to have you as a partner, and looking forward to doing more with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Finalis is a broker-dealer platform with everything that M&A advisors, investment bankers, and placement agents need to succeed. We deliver a broker-in-a-box regulatory affiliation solution, replete with tech-enabled compliance, research and analytics, deal lifecycle management tools, and a first-of-its-kind deal marketplace. Learn more at www.finalis.com. You've been listening to Pencils Down, a Finalis podcast. Keep connected with us by subscribing to the show on your favorite podcast player. If you like what you've heard, please rate the show. That helps us keep covering the latest in the private securities brokerage landscape. Thanks for listening. Until next time.